Welcome to my favorite podcast with Noah Marger.
It's been a long time, girl, since I saw your face. Hold me now, oh, hold my heart, hold inside my heart. Just stay with me, oh, stay with me, and a perfect storm, and a perfect storm. Oh, hold me now, Valerie. Honey, Valerie, see me. I'm the same boy I used to be.
That sucked.
I was like, that's like, these are like three different tidbits of songs that I know. Are they actually the same song, or is he just pivoting constantly?
I don't even know what the first one was.
Because as soon as you went to Hold Me Now, I was like, that can't be the same as the last song he was just singing, right?
Yeah, I didn't know.
Maybe. I don't know.
There's no good way to start a podcast.
Never. No, it's true. Maybe Comedy Bang Bang kind of stole it. Unless you think Marc Maron's intros are perfect and the hallmark of how to introduce a podcast.
Yeah, I didn't just get out of a halfway house, so I don't think that Marc Maron's intros are perfect. So.
What the fuck is fucking what the...
Yeah, exactly. What the fuck is up, fuckingeers? Fuck, what
let's fuck actually, you wanna
just, let's just do it. Let's just do that for the intro real quick. Right. You want to? We're just going to do that again. So
allow me.
So imagine the end of this. Lock the gates. What the fuck is up, fucking ears? My favorite podcast, Fuck Buddies. I don't know what the fuck he's supposed to say.
Ow! I just shit my pants.
Bow.
Instead of saying bow, he should scream, ow! I just shit my pants.
Oh, he's like Andrew Dice Clay. He's like, oh, there's shit in my fucking pants. Oh, how did that happen? It's because I was drinking bulletproof coffee 3 days beforehand. Yeah, there's no good way to start a podcast.
There's none. And that's what the podcast we're doing now and for the next, let's call it near 10 episodes. Yeah. That's the experiment we're going on. That's the adventure.
Yeah, ultimately we are going to be talking about the films of Paul Thomas Anderson, but the
question
we're trying to figure...
Sorry.
Fuck yeah.
I looked at our notes. I was like, this is 11 episodes. Hell yeah, let's fucking go.
We are going to be discussing the films Paul Thomas Anderson, but the question we're trying to answer is, what is a good way to start an episode of a podcast? So that's kind of the journey that you're going to be going on.
Yeah.
That's like that's the B game, so to speak.
Oh, of course. Yeah. A little live comedy show inside baseball, I guess.
Yeah. That's just going to be fun. That's just going to be a little inside. That's just inside baseball for us. By the way, are you ready to play some baseball?
Uh-oh. Yeah, let's do it.
By the way, you're pitching today.
Oh god. Okay. Yeah, sure. Let's do it.
Do you want me to do the singing? Do you want me to go back to the singing again?
You can do whatever you want, man. I'm here for you.
She's my sweet little thing. She's my pride and joy.
Should I just also sing random songs? Is that
that's probably good.
Okay. Yeah. Cuz I feel like did you like change anything about any of the lyrics you were singing, or are you just?
I don't
singing?
Even know if the first thing I sang was a song. To be honest with you, I was just kind of going with it.
It's
I was like,
kind of a
panicking.
This is like a. Are you familiar with Giant Bomb at all? Are you familiar with Giant Bomb at all?
I don't think so. Maybe if you explain
it's
it.
Like a video game content website with like journalists who are personalities, and I've been following since I was like seventh grade or something. They're great. Jeff Gerstmann, the likes. But there's a guy on there who would sing one of the Star Trek theme songs, which apparently starts like, it's been a long road or something like
the
that.
Fuck?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
No, that's apparently a start like either Next Generation
like a movie
it's a TV show. It's
damn.
Star Trek. It's been a long road. By the way, I have a mechanical keyboard, so.
Day. of podcasting. And we're listening to Marin instead of podcasting.
All right. I'm starting to feel bad for the listener now.
I have felt bad for the listeners for the last 71 episodes of this show.
Damn, dude. I want to play a game with you real quick. No, I just thought of this.
Okay, what's up?
Let's do it. I just created this game in my head. Let's play it real quick.
Yeah.
Letterboxd Battleship. You have to guess my top four currently, and I have to guess your top four currently.
The results by Andrew Bujalski.
In which position?
Fuck, that's not fair,
that's
dude.
Battleship, that's motherfucker. Fair. All right, fine. Let's do this. You're
two.
Correct. You're
am
correct.
I, am I correct?
Can okay. you see in the just... reflection of my glasses?
Yeah, I can. Actually, I'm on letterboxd.com looking at your profile.
Hey,
so.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, fun all way right. for us. Anyway, welcome back to My Favorite Podcast. This is a podcast about people's favorite things. I'm your host of the show, whether you like it or not, Noah Marger. This show's been on hiatus since basically Thanksgiving of last year. And we're back, and we're having fun today.
Yeah, absolutely, Noah. I'm having a ball of my life.
We're back, and we're having fun today. That's kind of the idea for the return of the show.
For sure. And welcome back, by the way. It's glad that you had such a wonderful adventure since the last episode of My Favorite Podcast. And it's been true. Great to see you. It's been great to do comedy with you and be buddies Thanks. With you again in real life. And I'm excited to be doing this mini series with you.
Thank you so much. And if you are not familiar with the dulcet tones on the other end of this Zoom call, brother, where the hell have you been for the last 71 episodes of this show? This voice should ring so familiar to you, you should be thinking about it as your own father's voice.
Oh, God.
Ultimately. If you don't know this man on the other end of the Zoom call, he is one of the core cast members and co-founders of the Everything Now Twitch stream, which you can watch Mondays and Thursdays at 8 p.m. Pacific on twitch.tv/everythingnowshow. He's a comedian. He's a filmmaker. He's a writer. You know this fucker through thick and thin. He's with me for the next 11 episodes, including the one today. My co-host for this miniseries about the films of Paul Thomas Anderson, Rocky Pajarito.
It's me, your father. I'm very disappointed in you all.
Fuck!
Just kidding. We're just goofing. Hi, everybody. It's me from Everything Now Show, Rocky. How's it going?
Rocky, what's going on in your day?
Oh, not much. I was just preparing for this whole little show and doing some writing and planning for life. I had a weird curveball was thrown toward me and my girlfriend this morning. So we're adjusting for the week, but I think things are going to be okay. And also, I'm excited to be watching Orphan First Kill tonight in theaters.
Slow down. What the fuck is Orphan First Kill?
Are you familiar with the movie Orphan?
I am, but just the way that rolled off your mouth made it seem like a Simpsons movie that Bart would want to go watch.
Orphan First Kill. I didn't give it the pause for the colon, but I don't even know if there is a colon. But yeah, Orphan First Kill is the prequel to Orphan from 2009.
Jesus.
Yeah, who knew? And it's funny because I didn't even see the first Orphan. I just knew the twist because I was a teenager in 2009. And, you know, that shit just kind of... You know, things just popped.
Yes, bro.
And I really want to watch it. I'm really excited to watch the first Orphan and to see its sequel. I'm sure they're not going to be great, but I'm going to have a good time regardless, I think.
Rocky, are you perchance using your AMC Stubs membership to go see this movie?
Why, yes, I am. I am also using it to order popcorn and candy and soda before I go to the theater.
Oh my gosh, I had no idea that we're not sponsored by them. It's just fun to talk about the product like this.
And we would just
oh my gosh,
this.
I had no idea that you could even do that. How do you do that? On the app, perchance?
That's true. As you're purchasing your free ticket for you or anyone in your entourage, which could be friends who are pre-approved, and you can buy their tickets for them as long
or
as they
family.
Are...
Or family. It could be family.
Or family, as long as they are participating AMC Stubs members. Before you check out, you will be prompted to buy popcorn or candy or combos or anything else of that ilk.
And it could be an old teacher of yours.
Yeah, if you, Mr. Detling, your sixth grade teacher to your AMC entourage,
an old Taekwondo instructor, perchance.
Yes, absolutely. I wish I remember the Taekwondo instructor's name from when I was in like third grade.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
So
you know him? Is he joining the Zoom call?
I'd like to welcome right now, Mr. Wah. But I had a. my dad made me do Taekwondo when I was like in late elementary school, and I really didn't want to do it. Like I really fought it. I just was like, this is going to be a waste of time for me. I could be spending this time playing Lego Star Wars or like anything else that I like cared about, you know?
That is so funny because I really wanted to do Taekwondo.
Can you guess really?
Can you guess why? Can you guess why I wanted to do Taekwondo?
So you could beat the shit out of your parents? I don't know.
It's true. I wanted to fight back. No, it's because my favorite Tekken character, Hwarang, fought in Taekwondo. And I was like, that guy's sick.
Which one is Hwarang?
I want to do that. He's the guy with the red hair and he has like motorcycle jeans and like tank tops. Nice. Yeah. He's like a hot guy.
I gotta get me a pair of those jeans to do Taekwondo.
Ultimately, that's what I should have done more so than the Taekwondo. But I got to the third belt, whether that was yellow or orange. I can't remember which one it was. I just remember crying because I hated doing like leg butterflies. You know that like warm up where you're like you're sitting crisscross applesauce and you're pushing down on your knees with your elbows.
Absolutely.
And yes. I remember crying having to do that. And then every sport experience after that was just kind of miserable, except for basketball. I did marching.
We were living parallel lives a little bit.
Unbelievable.
I did not want to be doing Taekwondo. I didn't actually mind the leg butterflies, to be honest with you. I thought those were kind of fun.
Good for you.
But my instructor, hey, thank you. My instructor's name,
Jim
O'Brien. That was my name of my Taekwondo instructor. The most Irish fucking name that you could imagine.
You might as well have had like Fred Simmons from the Foot Fist Way.
Literally.
Was it in like a shopping mall? Like a shopping center Taekwondo place? Or
yeah, it was a little like more upscale one, but nice. Like still it was technically a strip mall.
Got it. Mine was across the street, like in the same center was a Subway. A Blockbuster Video, a gas station was the closest thing to the Taekwondo area. And then also there's a Ralph's, a CVS, a Flame Broiler, and then our local bagel place. It is the ultimate shopping center, and I miss it, and I have no excuse to go back there anymore.
You could probably enroll in classes again. Yeah, I think it's been enough time.
Yeah, what else am I doing with my life right now? Yeah.
You could probably make the hour and a half commute up and down the I-5 like twice a week to go to class, I think.
Yeah, the 101 to the 5 to the 91, and then I'm back in Anaheim Hills. Yeah.
Holy fucking shit.
Holy my fucking God. I gotta close Twitter, bro.
I gotta delete my Twitter account entirely.
You know I gotta go to the bathroom, bro.
You know that it's time to take a shart in the bathroom.
All right, I got my notes up.
Rocky, can I ask you a few questions?
Please.
Before I do that, I looked at my notes and realized I jumped the gun. We're gonna watch all of PTA's movies, plus some extras. If you don't know who Paul Thomas Anderson is, just do a quick Goog, look him up. He's the best, probably my favorite director, and he's made some of my favorite movies. And I think that's probably fair to say for you as well, Rocky, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost cringe to say these days, but it's absolutely true. Some of his movies are so insanely formative for me, and are, I think, some of the best ever made, at least in America, in this you know, whatever the span of like the 90s into now are, whatever you want to call that. Just one of the foremost, you know, film thinkers, and it's good to celebrate his movies, and hopefully he keeps making and growing. And I'm excited to talk about all these films and how he's grown over them and revisit some of these dear, dear movies to me. there are some here that I'm like, that is like, you know, top of the totem pole as far as like movies go, or what is capable to be done with movies.
And we kind of did a backdoor pilot for this on the last episode of My Favorite Podcast that was recorded prior to this, where it was news, where we did Noahvember, or I did Noahvember, and the last episode of Noahvember was talking about Punch Drunk Love, which was his fourth feature film. We did a whole episode on that. We will not be discussing Punch Drunk Love as part of this series, but we basically did already. So go check that out if you think that is something you would like.
Listen to that shit, folks.
Fill it in. And say, hey, this is fun.
If you're getting into this podcast and you're like, why do they cover Punch Drunk Love? Then you just got to go back. You just got to scroll up. That's all you gotta
do. You just gotta scroll up. You gotta go to episode 71 and you gotta hear maybe the greatest D's Nuts joke of all time.
I was so proud of that. I think
it was amazing.
It's on Relay. I think I saw the recording. I'm gonna put that on Instagram and TikTok.
It's on Relay?
That's like my review for Punch Drunk Love on Relay.
Shout out to Relay. So yeah, we're going to talk about one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, possibly the greatest living filmmaker of all time. His name is Paul Thomas Anderson. Okay.
At least in America.
At least in America, and maybe you hate him, and maybe you're listening to this because you hate him, and that's fine too. And if you know Paul, and you know a way to get him on this show, I think he would have a fun time on this show with us. So hit me up in the DMs. I'll plug my socials at the end, and Rocky... Maybe if someone in your life knows Paul and wants to get him on the show, they can hit you up as well. But Rocky.
Yes, bro.
Listen to me for just one moment of your life for once. Okay.
Huh?
Okay. Yeah, cool. We got to start at the beginning, right?
All
right. We got to start at the beginning of this guy's whole thing. So that means we got to start about maybe his least seen narrative feature.
Yep. Absolutely.
And that is technically 1996, because it did premiere at Sundance in 1996.
It's fucking
true.
It didn't
come out in theatrical release until 1997. Gotta talk about Heart 8. Rocky.
Absolutely.
What was going on in your life when Heart 8 first came out?
Lordy, I cannot remember why I was on a trip with my parents, but I was on a trip with my parents, and they were out with friends or doing something, and I was in the hotel room. And I remember I had so much time that I just like watched a bunch of movies. This is really breaking down my childhood here. No, I was just like, I remember watching the other movie I remember watching during this. Two movies are Iron Man 2.
Whoa.
And Winning Season, an indie movie about a girls basketball coach in like middle school or high school, starring Sam Rockwell. And this is around the time that like I was really getting into Sam Rockwell as an actor. Moon had just come out and I was like, this guy is the real deal. And so I guess I watched those two movies because I couldn't get enough Sam Rockwell fever. But then I also remember this is probably I had just seen Magnolia or Punch Drunk Love maybe at this point. And I saw Heart 8 was on Netflix and I was like, that's his movie. That's the PTA guy movie. I'm going to go ahead and watch that. And I remember watching that and eating Denny's takeout and just kind of being like,
good. You said, yeah, that's pretty good.
It's pretty good. This is all right. But that's the picture I've painted of where I was when I first saw Heart 8. I think I've since seen it like maybe one or two more times since then. I'm going to say two more times, not including when I watched it for this podcast last night. But I don't know. I don't want to delve too deep, I guess, but that is where I first saw the movie.
I guess you answered my question I actually hadn't asked yet. I actually was asking, where were you in your life when this movie came out in 1996 and 1997?
I was two years old. I was maybe 1 year old at that point, actually, depending on the actual date of this release. But yeah, I was 2 years old.
Swags.
In Anaheim, probably, being a weird little kid.
You're probably being cute.
I probably just had my first soda, and then it was all downhill from there.
And you were like, fuck, this is the only thing keeping me from this is the only thing keeping me getting up in the morning, actually, is the idea that I get to drink soda today.
From ending it all. Yeah, weird, but true.
What was your first soda? Do you remember?
I can only imagine it was like a Coke or a Diet Coke, because Diet Coke really stuck. But I do remember my mom just kind of chastising my father for having given me soda so young. And look at me now, bro.
I remember when I was either this most recent time that I was out on the road or last summer when I was out on the road, I must have been in, you know where I was? I was in Roswell, New Mexico. I just realized it. I was in the alien center of the world.
Of course.
I was in Roswell and I was eating breakfast and there was this little toe-headed kid with his family in the high chair.
Sure.
And his mom brought in a bottle of Mountain Dew and poured it into like a kid's cup for him. This kid could not have been older than 2 years old.
No.
And I was like, that's Texas for you in New Mexico, I guess. Was, wow. I'm a little mortified, but also at the same time, I was like, that is what would I have really honestly expected otherwise?
Super fucking American, that's for sure.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah.
That's really I was cool. jealous of him.
Hey, long-term ramifications, I don't want to consider, but in the moment, I'm sure that was sick as shit for him.
It was fucking awesome. He was chugging that shit down, too, so this is clearly not the first time he's had Mountain Dew.
Of course. Like, fuck breast milk. I'm done with that shit. This is the new.
This is the new breast milk for me. This is my new tit milk. Can you ask for breast milk at Starbucks?
Are you asking?
I'm asking if I
could ask for it, or
I'm asking for it if it's available, because I don't want to ask the guy in front of me, you know, or the guy of the barista. I just need to know if it's available so I can just ask for it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they have it, so you should ask.
Cool. So I was not born yet when this movie premiered at Sundance.
Thought so. Yeah, I was gonna say.
I was swimming around in my dad's balls, nice. In the great wide open. But technically, when it was theatrically released outside of Sundance, it was technically, I think, February of 1997. So I was freshly 2 months old, living in Cleveland, Ohio with mom and dad, because that's where I was fucking born.
Nice. I didn't know that.
My dad was working for Frito-Lay.
That's also awesome. Wow.
It's kind of awesome. I don't know why he ever left that job.
That's a bummer.
He worked for Frito-Lay, though, in Cleveland, Ohio. I think he had to drive a truck, but that wasn't his main responsibility. I think he was a floor guy, maybe even a salesman at that point, because he did a lot of that. But that's why we lived in Cleveland, so work for Frito-Lay.
Tight as hell. But when this was premiering at Sundance, you were simply in your dad's balls playing pickup games of basketball with the other sperm, right?
With the other sperm saying, yeah, I don't, you know, guys, whoever makes it out of here, you know, we gotta live with each other. We gotta live for the homies, you know, basically. We gotta live for the homies who didn't make it out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Remember where you're from.
I'm the one who made it out, and I was like, peace, bitches. And then I like kicked dirt. And I was like a dog who just took a shit at the park and is like scratching the grass backwards. I was like, fuck y'all.
Kick. Yeah. Yeah. Baller. Baller move.
That's where I was when this movie came out. And then when I watched it for the first time, I looked back. It was June of 2019 when I watched this movie for the first time.
Hot dog.
According to Letterboxd.com. And that was a very interesting time period for me, because that was precisely, I had graduated from college, but I hadn't moved to LA yet.
Wow.
I was still living in Orange County.
Cool.
And I was in that just fresh off graduation haze of what the fuck am I supposed to do now?
Mm-hmm.
And I watched it in my college apartment. Probably it was streaming on Prime or something like that, and I hadn't watched it yet, and I was just like, all right, before I go into the real world, I should watch Hard Eight, because it's one of the only PTA movies I haven't seen yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, and I thought it was okay when I first watched it, but I was also, again, very clouded in that moment by what the fuck am I supposed to be doing. And then I watched it again, and I think, what was it, what did I write down, November 2020, late 2020 is when I watched it again, and I liked it more. Obviously, that was a lockdown watch. Everyone was pretty much locked down at that point, and so had a lot of time on my hands, and I'm like, let's give this one another watch. I think I was in the mood for some neo-noir like crime thing, you know? And I was like, let's give this another watch, and I liked it more. And
you wrote your review like you're a guest critic on At the Movies. It says,
What did I say?
Don't skip Hard Eight.
That's fucked that I said don't skip Hard 8. But it's true. Don't skip Hard 8.
Sure. I agree.
Because the trend is, Rocky, I watched it again yesterday, just like you did, for this podcast. And I can safely say I actually liked it even more this time than I did in the 2020 watch. Just like I think a lot of PTA movies, they only get better the more you watch them. Because those first watches, especially in his The Master, Inherent Vice, Phantom Thread era, first watches are really tough of those movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what I mean? Especially later on, you're right. It is kind of like he is playing so much more with abstraction and lack of context and pure action and whatnot. But this is kind of back to his like much more in your face and straightforward era, pretty much up until Punch Drunk Love, I'd say. I mean, but even like my girlfriend,
I was just gonna say Magnolia's got some abstractions for sure.
This is an interesting question, actually. My girlfriend asked me this last night while we were watching this. Do you think this is his most accessible movie?
Did you say accessible?
Yes, accessible movie.
Yeah, either that or Licorice Pizza, I think.
Which probably is crazy to me. But also, like, I get it. Like, Licorice Pizza is, like, bizarre. I mean, I don't know. I think also Licorice Pizza suffers from the three previous movies being kind of, like head scratcher, like, you know, weirdo dramas or whatever.
Up their like they're almost up their own mind's ass in that way, where it's like just so freaky and so like personal and so stark that it is like holy shit. But I've actually never thought of PTA as being inaccessible, so that's kind of interesting that your girlfriend would ask that. I don't want to dox her name on the pod. She's been on the pod.
That's fine.
I don't want to say her name, but if she doesn't want that, so your girlfriend. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've never thought of PTA as inaccessible, but this definitely is, of all of his movies thus far, this is him doing a genre movie more so than any other movie that he's made.
Definitely. And while, you know, I'd say that it's not like necessarily straightforward until about 40 minutes into it, which is the thing I really like about it. Like, I kind of like that it meanders and does have this kind of, like, I finally see the quality of Altman that everyone says that he kind of, you know, pulled from a little bit. It kind of turns into Scorsese in the halfway point, I guess. But at the first part, there's like just kind of like the plot is not really existent and is just following these two characters and a bunch of actions they're taking. And then you kind of focus on the gestures that they're giving to each other, essentially. And it's also Demi, another one of his, you know, heroes he emulates and whatnot. And that's great. I'm going to give it back to you. What were we talking about before I interrupted?
Back to you, stinkhead. That's what you should say to me.
Back to you in the studio, stink boy.
Thank you, Finker. Thank you, Finker. Let's talk. I got a few talking points here that we can jump off here.
Go ahead, Captain.
Thank you, Finker number two. I personally like the first half of this movie more than the second half because they are very stark and different from each other. What do you think?
I agree. I think it's interesting what he tries to do in the second half, but it slowly becomes a worse movie as it goes on until the very end. Until like there's a very specific scene that takes place in a motel room. And from that point on, the movie kind of slowly is just a gradual decline down in terms of excitement and quality filmmaking, I would say. I mean, there's like, you know, there's a lot of like textural elements of Paul Thomas Anderson movies that like kind of come along in the future. Like the sound design is great. It continues to look good, obviously, but on a writing standpoint, though, it's an interesting idea that there's these like acts two and three are like kind of individual short films featuring these characters or whatever.
Yeah.
They're not as interesting or well, oiled as one could expect from future PTA works, but that's also my opinion.
I definitely think that this watch for me, and it was only on watch three where I did feel a sense of tension and a sense of like excitement about, oh, how is this final moment going to go down basically for everyone? And then you kind of have this like cyclical moment in the very, very end of the film.
Yeah.
That like last moment, it's like, oh, is this just this guy's whole fucking life is going to diners and preying on young men who he may have some weird history with their families, who knows?
Yeah.
But the first half of this movie feels really special, and I think that's where you see the PTA-ness of the whole thing start to kind of unfurl and start to grow and start to blossom. Is these moments, that opening shot in front of Jack's diner is really a nice little like slice of life, low or small town America type thing with beautiful Elswit photography and the way that we push in and it's just one shot to start the movie. he's so economical as a filmmaker, and I don't know if that's something that he gets a lot of attention for, but I would love to do a watch of Punch Drunk Love one day and just count how many shots made the final cut, because I bet you it's way less than we think it is. You know what I mean?
Definitely. There's a lot of scenes in that movie in particular that take place in, you know, like a very few amount of shots, if not just one, for the sake of, yes, you know, unique blocking or tension and whatever like that. He's really good at doing that kind of stuff. And that comes through in here a little bit in that motel scene we'll talk about. But yeah, the first 40 minutes of this movie, I think, are all beautifully done. And that first scene in particular, and that first shot are, yeah, exquisite and show us kind of what he's capable of painting as far as his America and his Americans go. Like, yes, even like little things like just like the sound design of the semi truck that passes by John at the beginning, it feels like,
oh yeah,
ripped straight out of Punch Drunk Love. And it is this like kind of loud, roaring, alive sensation that it gives. And then like it also is that first scene taking place at like dawn, like 6 a.m. kind of. It looks really, yeah, early.
Yeah, early morning. The John C. Reilly character, who also happens to be named John,
yeah,
you can tell that he's kind of had a burnout night of, yeah, some kind. And like he might be sitting outside that diner as a way to end his night and kind of like move on with to the next day. He might be trying to go to sleep. He might be just like, I just need a place to fucking sit, yeah, for the moment being. Because I want to actually talk about this cast, because it really only is four actors.
Pretty much, yeah. There's like maybe there's one more actor that I would say has a very crucial inclusion here. But yes, I agree. It is mainly these four main characters that are the kind of leads of this chamber, or whatever the term is, I guess. But also, I want to just to say goodbye to this, yes, shot as we talk about,
yeah,
this,
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
If you think about all the movies that he goes on to make and the kind of feelings that they elicit about loneliness and this kind of existential, like, you know, being lost in the cosmic, you know, massiveness, yeah, of existence and whatnot. What a beautiful opening shot. Like, you know, I mean,
absolutely.
Riley's amazing in this movie in his own special way. It's really seeing him unlock himself as an actor. It's not really his movie, but the framing of this guy sitting by himself quietly, you know, hunched down and balled up within himself is in itself like such a beautiful intro to this guy's career and his, like, you know, yes, his ethos as a storyteller. And it's maybe like the best of his storytelling. There's a lot of things in this movie that are like the worst of his storytelling maybe also. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's a great way to open this movie and his career. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Those first, like you said, those first 40 minutes where Sydney, aka Philip Baker Hall, is just kind of giving John the lowdown, mm-hmm, of how more or less he exists in this world,
yeah,
and how you can scam casinos into getting what you want, which, Rocky, is that a leftist move to do something like that? Is to scam a casino into getting what you want? I think that's actually pretty cool.
I think it's kind of woke. I think it's woke and also based.
It's one of the most based things that happens in a PTA movie is scamming a casino to give you a free room.
It's fucking true. It actually feels a lot like Licorice Pizza in hindsight of like all the weird schemes that they're pulling off and whatnot. But absolutely. Yeah, I think it's so.
Do you think PTA like grew up like trying to do the quarter on the string trick on the vending machine?
God,
and stuff?
He literally seems like he was like Eddie in Ed, Edd n Eddy.
He was like the ringleader trying to get everyone else to like do the schemes. I feel like as a director, you kind of have that like ringleader,
yeah,
quality.
100%.
Put the team together. And so he was like, instead of making a movie, it was like, hey, we're going to tip this vending machine over so that we can get free sun chips at the pool. That's what we're doing today, boys.
Yeah.
And they were like, sure, whatever. As long as we get free chips.
That sounds like Paul Thomas. Yeah.
Our close personal friend who we know, Paul Thomas Anderson, who we love and has given his blessing of this podcast.
He agreed to it. He signed off on it. Yeah.
He said, this is the officially licensed PTA podcast, and that's cool for you boys, and I'm going to let you do whatever you want with it. I'm not going to give you any notes.
This is your art. This is your art, he says, and we're really appreciative of that.
He says, I know what it's like to not have Final Cut on my first feature ever and then only have Final Cut going forward, so I'm going to give that to you guys.
Fucking Kid Wonder. God, this guy. Yeah, also...
I got some fast facts about that later. That there's one thing that I never fully realized about this going into his next movie, which I'll share in the Fast Facts, which will just blow your fucking socks off. But
moving on, real quick thing. If you're interested in hearing about this particular moment in his career making this movie and the struggles he had with it, I highly recommend checking out his WTF interview, actually.
Oh, let's go. Okay.
Yeah,
let's loop Marin back into this in a real way.
Exactly. Sincerely. I mean, he has a good interview for sure. But the Hard Eight stuff in particular is very interesting because you really get to hear him talk about his disappointments in the movie. Not so much like, you know, in like the filmmaking, but like in the process of making the movie before he becomes this kind of like prince that gets whatever he wants for a couple movies.
Dude, I doing just even cursory research for this show, he really got put through the ringer because, spoiler alert for the Fast Facts, he wrote the script for this in 1992. The movie doesn't come out until 1996 at Sundance. That's 4 years of having a completed script and probably up to having a completed movie. But really, that movie that we know as Hard Eight, that most people know of who have seen, came out in like early 97. So that's basically 5 years of having a completed script and not really being able to do much with it. I mean, that sucks for anyone, not even just PTA.
Yeah. I mean, also, like, he's what, a first-time filmmaker, a feature filmmaker at this point. And he's gone through a Sundance lab or institution at some point for this. And he greased the wheel on Philip Baker Hall to get him interested in making this movie in the first place. Like, he had to do a lot of his, like, you know, what he does best. Like, I mean, at the time, at least, he was like, you know, like a smooth talker. He's kind of like that. I don't know.
He's scheming.
Like, to get this movie made, he clearly schemed a lot. But in the long run, he kind of got the ball taken away from him before he could even get it in the hoop. Wow, what a metaphor.
I was just about to say, man, my man's breaking out the sports metaphors, brother. It's 12:24 p.m. Come on now. This is Sunday. Come on now. NFL doesn't even come back for a couple more weeks. Come on now. Can we talk about the cast, please?
Yeah, fine.
So we got four main ensemble members, and it's funny to call this an ensemble movie because really the next couple movies are true ensemble.
Actual ass ensembles, yeah.
But here we got John C. Reilly as John.
Yep.
We got Philip Baker Hall as Sydney.
Yep.
We got Gwyneth Paltrow as Clementine. Mm-hmm. Clementine, as the next guy calls her.
He does say that, yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson, of all people, as Jimmy. It's really kind of weird to think that Samuel L. Jackson and PTA have worked together.
I agree.
It still doesn't really, like, compute for me.
It's kind of unfortunate because it is like, you know, why isn't this, like, the most magical performance ever? There's a lot of good stuff in it. Like, Samuel L. Jackson does get some fun lines, and he does well with everything he's given, basically. But I'd also dare say that near the end, the writing for his character becomes less interesting or exciting to me. But
yes.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll get to those scenes later. But yeah, I mean, Samuel L. Jackson, totally in not only a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, but the first one. And he's
the first one.
Yeah, and this is like right after doing Jurassic Park and Pulp Fiction, I'm pretty sure. So he's kind of out there and being like the new character actor to have in like a major role in your movie.
Yeah, if you want someone who's going to bring immediate excitement, you're going to cast Samuel L. Jackson, especially this era of Samuel L. Jackson. Like, at one point, I think Samuel L. Jackson was, like, the highest grossing per actor by, like, box office total gross. And, of course, that he has the benefit of having been in some, like, major ass movies like the MCU and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, and he's not necessarily, like, driving those. But at the same time, I want to see him on screen. He's such an electric force.
Oh, yeah. Know? Yeah. It's like a kind of, he's like a well-working vending machine where you put in your coin and you get exactly what you want from him. Like whatever in your head you could imagine you want from Samuel L. Jackson, you pretty much get it every time he's on screen. Like no matter what.
PTA and his friends tried to tip him over when they were kids.
Yeah, exactly. tried scheming
to get
him.
Free soda. Yeah, free Sun Chips out of Samuel L. Jackson. Shitting out fully packaged Sun Chips.
Jesus Christ.
He's like, why are you guys tipping me over? He says that. He says, why are you guys
Who
tipping me over?
Who the hell told you you could do this?
And you will know that you don't touch my ass when I'm pooping out Sun Chips. But this is really Philip Baker Hall's movie at the end of it at all.
Yeah, and this movie was literally supposed to be titled Sydney. So it's specifically about his character. And I agree. I mean, I think that's the most interesting way to watch it, you know, like God bless John C. Reilly and Gwyneth Paltrow and Samuel L. Jackson. But this movie is about what's going on in this guy's head and the actions he takes for, you know, and the reasons he takes them, I guess.
Yeah, his performance is so layered because he is so mysterious for the majority of this film. But you get this, like, redemption, like, deep down in him that he wants to make this thing right.
Yeah.
But he is... And I don't even want to say he's a bad guy, because he's not really a bad guy. He's just done some really kind of shitty things.
Sure.
And he's trying to be saved from them. And through that, he's trying to save this John character. And you get the first inkling of what I think is sort of a secret sauce to a lot of great PTA movies, and some of my favorite movies of his, is the familial connection, that trying to create a family feeling, whether it's with your chosen family or with your biological family, and the heartache that comes from that thing. It's very subdued in this one, and it gets only more exacerbated as we go on in his career. But that wanting for a familial connection, especially a father-son connection, I think it's immediately apparent in this movie. Maybe not right off the bat if it's your first watch, but upon rewatch, it's like, damn, this Sydney guy, all he wants to do is kind of save himself and kind of like save his soul a little bit. And he's just, he's in a bad world and in a bad space, but he's not a bad guy.
It's got to, yeah, to that degree, it uses its vibes very well in a noir sense. And as you kind of, the movie progresses and goes on, you do get the sense of the three main characters in particular, Clementine, John, and Sydney, all realizing how much they all mean to each other, like at a very critical moment. And then for Sydney in particular, you kind of see this guy who's pushed to the brink and essentially forced to ask, and not the most, you know, like it isn't this on the nose or whatever, but it's like, you know, like, how far are you willing to go for these people that you love? Or like, what really matters to you in this life? Do you even care about living anymore, really? And you kind of see it in, it's everything in Philip Baker Hall's face and his like voice and his performance. Like, you really see this change in character, and then like the determination to do whatever it takes to make sure that the people he loves, you know, like get away safe, essentially.
And he's willing to do self-sacrifice in order to do that. He's willing to go to self-sacrifice in order to make that happen.
Yeah. In that sense, and I think, you know, I like this conversation about this movie. It does make me kind of want to watch it again, because I think about the first 40 minutes in particular of Sydney just wandering around these casinos as this weird purgatory of him, like, you know, seeing old and young all together. And it's just people are coming in and out. It is this like ever rotating, like, you know,
it's a limbo.
Yeah. It's like a limbo and kind of a fish tank kind of. And it's very interesting seeing it through his eyes, and also through Roger Elswit. What's his favorite name?
Robert Elswit.
Robert Elswit. I almost said Roger, because that's Deacons, right?
That's Deacons. This is Robert.
If Robert he be, Elswit is ye.
Elswit in morning, that's a movie. And Deacons at night, that's a fright.
Yes.
Which is true.
Yeah.
Which is true, by
the way. It's very true, yeah. But anyway, something
that people say.
That's a very great observation. And I think this movie does succeed so well at its most, because particularly of Philip Baker Hall's performance. Like, this is a journey across that guy's face and in that guy's heart.
100%. And I wanted to touch on something else that you said that I have written down, which is the casinos in this movie are awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That stuff, that's where you can kind of tell he's just kind of playing. Like, I don't know. Because there's not, like, you know, there's, like, things that are happening for the character that are painting his character and his morals and his attitude and how he acts and reacts to certain things, but getting to just glide through casinos and see funny characters and interesting people in close up saying silly shit and stuff like that is very exciting, I can tell, for PTA. And it's exciting for me too. It's fun to watch him just kind of exist as a filmmaker before having to really force a plot together.
Yeah. And he's able to just kind of show Sydney in the space. And what I love about those tracking shots, especially of just Sydney walking through the casino grounds, is we don't ever see his face.
Yeah.
Ever like on like straight up on the front of it. We only ever get glimpses from the profile, the side, and usually just the back of his head. Mm-hmm. And watching this person glide through this space and how they feel about the space, how they interact with the space.
How the space reacts to them.
How the space reacts to them. Spoiler alert. When we get to the categories, that might be a very important thing for me. Haha. Whoa, that's crazy as fuck. We're going to have some categories later.
I like it.
But the casinos in this movie are great because they're not Caesar's Palace. They're not the Venetian.
They're in Reno, man.
Yeah, it's like you came here to gamble. You didn't come here to have a weekend. You came here because you want to gamble.
Yeah, and this is like the kind of baseline what... God, casinos are so crazy. I really enjoy wandering around them, but I also get kind of sick thinking a little bit about gambling addiction and how scary it can be. But there's also something very, you know, charming and again, American about the whole thing. I don't, have you seen Melvin and Howard?
No, I actually haven't seen that.
There's a lot that PTA lifts from Melvin and Howard, a lot from The Master in particular. But there is an amazing scene where main characters get married at one point, and they have a honeymoon in, I think, Vegas or just some sort of casino or something like that. And it feels very similar to this, where you just kind of see, I don't know, this kind of like charming but dull American life kind of on display.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And like, you know, the colorful lights almost kind of contrast the like weird depressiveness of the whole location or the whole endeavor.
Yeah, and it almost exacerbate them in some way because it's mm-hmm. like, oh, your environment is giving off this glow, this charm, this big spectacle.
Yeah.
And I think about that a lot in the kind of the bridge between act two and three of this movie.
Yeah.
When I almost called him Jimmy Gator. When when Sydney and Jimmy meet mm-hmm. in the car and kind of have their confrontation. That shot where it's the backs of their heads and the lights are just kind of going off through the windshield in the background, which is, you know, in the foreground for the characters or whatever. It's what they're looking at.
Yeah.
That to me is like, oh yeah, this sucks shit for them. Like, this is not glamorous for them at all. This is like seedy and desperate.
Them. Oh yeah. No, I mean, it is. Like going into the motel also, there is this like, you know, whatever's in the shadows of the bright lights and the fun and the jangling of the coins and like the jackpot noises and whatnot.
Yes.
Like it gets so, so grim, almost like in the non-fun way. But I think that's kind of obviously the point. And also PTA explores that in this and Boogie Nights in particular and Punch Drunk Love, I guess, to a little degree. But like these like weird, like, when you are sucked into the scariest parts of humanity, like very suddenly in America, when it's like, you know, seems like out of nowhere, you know, like just around the corner, people are there to hurt you and take advantage of you.
Yeah. And that's when I first watched the movie. I really thought that's what Sydney was going to do to John. Like the first time I watched the movie, I'm like, This is a stranger approaching him at a diner somewhere in the like the West Coast, Western United States.
Yeah.
Why is he doing this? Does he want to suck his dick? And Johnny C. Reilly like even says that to him. He's like, I'm not fucking gay, bro.
Yeah.
Basically, he gives him the no homo speech in the diner.
If you're looking for a boy hooker, I'm pretty sure he says at some point.
Does he say boy hooker? That's crazy.
Maybe. I don't know if I wrote that down, but he basically talks like that and then says he knows three kinds of karate, including generic karate.
Saying that you know generic karate just is a dead giveaway that you don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Exactly.
Ass.
But hearing John C. Reilly say it too is so good and funny.
I said it on a former podcast of mine called It's on the List, if you've heard of that.
I don't know what you're talking what you're talking about.
Okay.
I don't listen to podcasts.
Okay.
I don't hang out with guys named Mason.
Okay. I said that I think the two most versatile actors alive today are Jeff Daniels and John C. Reilly. And John C. Reilly to like a crazy degree because he's able to do Steve Brule. And was nominated for an Oscar for Chicago for playing Amos Hart. You know, to me, that is Like, almost sickening how wide of a range that that man has to, like, do that. Jeff Daniels is amazing in his own right, but I don't know if Jeff Daniels is down to do, so, like, a Steve Brule character either, you know?
You know, it's... I don't know of any more, but he also fucking went to bat and did the goddamn Dumb and Dumber sequel, no matter how bad or good it is, you know? But,
yeah, he's a king for that.
Yeah, I'd say pre-2010, anything before The Newsroom, Jeff Daniels is such a cool, promising actor. And just not a problem. He's like, he's so sincerely great and so fun and scary and sad and funny. Yeah, I fully agree. And I'd say I love watching John C. Reilly, and I love seeing him in things that aren't straight up comedies, because I just kind of know, like, I'm going to see a very interesting angle from him, and he knows how to handle those or bring something unique to them.
And I don't know if you heard this, but America is not the greatest country in the world. the classic 2014
that
Facebook video
fucking scene is so goddamn. Oh god, I love it. I love how self-serious that scene is, and like
awesome.
Holding up the sign. Yeah, getting sent that on Facebook by your uncle or something.
I love. Yeah, for me, it was like in high school, like. Mm-hmm. The girls who were like starting to like get self-righteous about politics.
Of course,
it was the Facebook video version where it was like white top text caption, bottom like white text caption where it's like, this is the fucking truth or something like that.
I
loved getting that video on the timeline every like 6 months.
Absolutely. And I also kind of love that, like, it's not like they're trying to say it's not from a TV show, but there is this kind of weird energy of like, you know, you could see someone watching and being like, happened. Is this real?
Did this actually, it's me saying, did this actually happen? On a tweet that I know for a fact did not actually happen in real life, but I'm being serious.
It's
about
a fun move. It's a fun move.
Hey, did this actually happen when you slept with a giant life-size Barbie and made her come? Hey, did this actually happen? I don't know.
Who knows?
Doesn't matter to me.
Okay.
Hey, who cares? I'll say this while you're looking through your notes.
Sure.
Two composers, Michael Penn and John Bryan,
that's
responsible
right.
for this, the music in this movie. And I think it's kind of an underrated part of this movie. I think that this movie has a really nice little score.
It's crucial. I was pretty much going to bring that up. That's kind of what stood out to me. Like, I know we're going to talk about, you know, picking our favorite somethings in a little bit. But the moment that John starts to consider accepting Sydney's offer, the music does this beautiful swell of pianos, clarinets, and horns. And it is kind of like the first major Paul Thomas Anderson music moment, because he 100%. Works so closely with his composers. Like, they are such a crucial part of the feeling that he elicits in all of his movies.
Yeah.
Johnny
They're
Greenwood.
One of the major storytellers.
Exactly. Johnny Greenwood is such a near the top of the call sheet for how important they are in terms of creating a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. And John Bryan also, I think, is like a genius. And I think this is a really great use of his talent. Like, all the jazz themes are really cool and moody. But that opening piano piece, or like, you know, like the piano and the horns and all the stuff like building up, is really great. There's also... is like, you know, this is a two-time PTA, it's not a cast member, it's not a person, it's a music cue. But the weird, the bell and the kind of piano theme that plays under the opening credits, and also plays in Boogie Nights when...
like transformative moments.
Exactly, is so insanely haunting.
Yes,
and
it is.
It was. I watched this on our TV, which is like, you know, decently sized, and like the, you know, like the sound was coming in pretty good, and it is so like unnerving to listen to. I love that he uses it several times because it's so effective, and it's like such a great tool. And his music, I think, later on with Johnny Greenwood, goes on to emulate that kind of feeling a lot. If not in different ways of like discordant melodies or things that don't even have a melody at all and just kind of feel crazy.
It's very like there's a very much a storyteller feel to it. It almost feels like a sound cue and like a from whom the bell tolls, it tolls for I
yeah.
kind of moment.
Or like know? Like it's the freaking really like the overture of 2001. Like if you like get lucky yeah. enough to see it in a theater with an overture, it does have this weird like the screen's black and you just hear these haunting noises creeping in that are kind yes. of cluing you into what this movie turns into eventually. Yeah, it's a really cool use of that music cue, and I'm glad that he found it and used it or whatever it is. It feels like a John Bryan sample, like because John Bryan uses samples very well. Really good use of diegetic music in that opening scene in particular, in yes. the diner. I thought it was great. Casino lights are so beautiful. There's some just great loose lines here and there that are my favorite thing about PTA. Here, okay, I'll bring up a thing that I actually. Is going to be specifically about the first three movies of this
okay.
you know thing, and also Licorice Pizza, I guess. But let's talk about his dialogue. I think okay. There's some really
talk about it.
There's some really great lines of dialogue here. One of them is like the guy at the Kino bar who says, "Cupid has found its way." that's very PTA. Yeah. It's very kind of clumsy, but also charming. And then also Sydney at the end of the kind of scheme sequence. He says, "It's always nice to make a new friend," which, you know, the way he says it is very curt, very serious. He's still kind yeah. of serious or whatever, but it is also very heartbreakingly sincere. And you, and yes. as the movie goes on, you kind of realize how real that is, you know?
And that's a thing where one of the things I like about him the most,
mm-hmm.
PTA, that being PTA, is, and you feel it in this movie, and you really start to feel it even more as time goes on and in different iterations and ways, even in times where you don't expect it.
Yeah.
I think that he is one of the warmest filmmakers.
100%.
Every movie feels so warm and so loving, even in the moments of doubt and pain, yeah. you know? And there's one in particular where I think he almost like tries to subvert that, but I don't want to fully get into that yet. But it's coming down the pike, and we will talk about it. But
for sure,
that warmth, you really start to feel that warmth
oh, yeah.
in this movie, like right off the bat. You know, there are those things that he's kind of planting his flag down, and you can see like, oh, we are going to be feeling these things throughout this guy's career. We're going to be seeing these things repeat. We're going to be laughing at his movies. And we're going to be crying at his movies, too.
He gives you the 1-2 punch, people, and he'll do it every single goddamn time.
And he wipes your ass.
He'll wipe your ass for you.
He'll say, "Do you have a poopy ass? Do you need me to wipe?" "Sure, I'll come to my house tonight. I'll wipe it for you." And then you go, "Really?" And he goes, "No, get the fuck out." And he kicks you in the butt, the perineum.
And then you like fly into the sky because he kicked you so hard there.
It kicks you so hard in the perineum, and you're like, "Oh, my perineum," which I call my gooch, actually, which I call, and some of my friends call it the taint, but I call it the gooch. That's the perineum, right? Is the gooch?
It might be. I don't want to Google it, but I think you're yeah. right.
We're not going to Google it. We're yeah. going to go with it.
This is a really good note, and we could discuss this. Do you understand the casino scheme he pulls?
Not at all.
I don't think you're supposed to, really, right? Like it is
don't
like
get it at all.
There is just enough detail where you're like, okay, I can see where there's like an error being made on behalf of the casino, but whatever. He seems to be making money, I guess, so it's fine. But it kind of
I don't fully understand what a rate card is.
Same, which feels like a very, very primitive piece of tech or something.
Yes.
Like I don't know if it's even used in casinos anymore. Maybe the same ethos is used, but like I could see that being scammed like this perhaps, and that's why they don't use them or something. But
100%.
Yeah. But anyway,
fuck. In Punch Drunk Love there's a scam. He's doing a scam in Punch Drunk Love too.
He's a schemer, dude. Yeah, these sad fuck. Schemers. Yeah, that's what he does.
Jesus Christ. It just occurred to me I get to watch the rest of PTA's movies over the next couple months.
Yeah, we're lucky.
That's very exciting to me.
Yeah.
I get to watch Boogie Nights this coming week.
I get to rewatch The Master. I'm so yeah. excited about that.
Like we are so lucky. You're so right that we are like putting ourselves in a position to watch all of these guys' movies. And there's only one of his movies that I've only seen one time, and I don't want to say which one it is yet, ooh. But I have been trying to rewatch that one for a while, mm-hmm. and this is going to be the perfect opportunity to do it. Yeah. And I just got a new TV, and so I'm like actually down to watch shit in my apartment now. And I had my 32 inch Samsung, just regular ass TV for the last 6 years, and like last month I upgraded to a 55 inch TCL plus Roku TV.
Good for you.
And I'm telling you, dude. And it wasn't even that expensive. Yeah, that was the crazy thing.
I know. I'm with you. Yeah, they are decently priced these days. Yeah.
You can get a really nice TV for like less than you would think. I'm not going to say how much I spent, but like less than you would. The TV is better than the price I paid for it, for sure.
Hell yeah. I'm happy for you.
Thank you.
Of course.
But I'm so, so glad we actually get to watch PTA movies.
I know. And you get to watch them in like a really nice fashion, too.
In order from smelly to stinky,
as he
from unwashed to washed laundry,
to pee
to what the fuck was that? It smells like garbage. To I'm gonna throw up the org. Fast facts.
What did you call me?
Sydney. Shh. Called you fast facts. Originally titled Sydney, it was Anderson's first feature film and the expansion of the short film Cigarettes and Coffee. The main character Sydney was named after Hall's previous role in Midnight Run. In Midnight Run, Philip Baker Hall had a small role as a man named Sydney who lives in Las Vegas and is connected to the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think it's nice.
Kind of insane that he said, oh, I'm going to have my movie be about that guy. For but sure. It is cool that he did that.
He also mentions Jimmy Gator at some point, which is his character in Magnolia.
Oh, brother, you read my mind, because my next fact is when Jimmy and Sydney have their confrontation, Jimmy mentions that he knows Sydney's friends Lloyd Gondoli and Jimmy Gator. Lloyd Gondoli is who Philip Baker Hall plays in Boogie Nights, and Jimmy Gator is who he plays in Magnolia.
Well, that's just silly.
That's just so silly.
That's just a silly thing. That's cool.
Since it was his first film and he basically had no control over it, Reicher Entertainment recut the film and retitled it Hard Eight. This enraged Anderson, and though through many talks and deals, scheming and dealing, he convinced the studio to let him release his cut, but with the new title Hard Eight. Anderson later said this experience taught him that doing your best to make the movie is only half the job when being a director. The other half was dealing with all of the egos involved. Is that more or less the Marin talk that he gives?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Marin has to kind of pull it out of him, but he does kind of like show some very interesting self-effacing, just kind of like acknowledgement of how the situation went, basically. It's interesting to listen to.
What else do we? I got some more stuff here.
Yeah, I feel like I had something based on what you were saying. Do you think Sydney's a better title?
Yes, I think so. Because Hard Eight to me is sort of meaningless on face value. Like, I don't think of it as a thing other than the title of this movie.
Yeah, I'd say that within the film, like, the scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman is good, like, and interesting, and I think it uses the word heartache, like, in an interesting way enough that I'm like, okay, that can be the title of this movie, sure. I do think it's very silly when Samuel Jackson's gambling later, and he's like, I'm gonna do heartache. Yes. And he's like, I win.
That to me, those scenes don't really parallel each other other than the mention of the Hard Eight. And I thought to myself, well, why does the scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman even exist in this movie? Like, what purpose does it serve?
Yeah.
And I think it's ultimately to show us what Sydney's made of ultimately and how he's able to handle high pressure situations. Cause then we immediately kind of go into the plot-y part of the film.
Yeah.
And Hard Eight also basically, for those uninformed, is more or less saying, I'm doubling down that this is going to be a 4 and a 4 on the 2 die.
This is very specific thing.
Not any other combination of 8. It's going to be one die is going to be 4. The other die is going to be 4. And that's a Hard Eight. And it's more of a payout.
Mm-hmm.
So, some gambling terminology for my friends.
Yep. And the connection to like whatever thematic weight it might have with these characters and whatnot is like gambling on people and like putting their trust in each other and that kind of stuff.
Totally.
But it's not a terrible title. But I also do have a weird pet peeve about movies that are just named after the main character's name. It just kind of feels like, especially if the movie I watch it and I'm like, I don't give a shit about this character. They're not even like a good main character. Then it kind of, kind of bums me out a little bit. And I think it's just like super lazy storytelling. But
I guess at the end of the day, neither title to me is like that good. Sure. Ultimately, like, I don't love either title. Heart 8 is maybe a little more interesting sounding
sure.
than Sydney
yeah.
is. And yet, and so yet. It goes.
Yeah, and so it goes. That and also so feels like a PTA-ism.
It like, is, 100%.
And so it happens, or like, so then this happens, kind of like weird biblical dialogue.
And then everyone's like, dude, did you fucking do that on purpose? And he's like, yes, I did do that on purpose.
Because did.
Nothing happens in my movies on accident.
Yeah. We'll talk about this, but it's so funny to me how he talks about these first three movies versus how he talks about Punch Drunk Love. Like, there was a clip on, I think, Twitter that was going around of Coppola, Francis Ford Coppola, asking him, like, did you know what you were doing with Punch Drunk Love? And every time you see an interview of PTA about that movie, he's very like, I don't know what happened. And in that wow. interview, in that talk with Coppola, he even says, like, the first 3 weeks I thought I was gonna die. I did not know what we were doing. And then
and then
slowly but surely we realized like what ties together and what works and that it actually is feeling good. And then he kind of went on from there or whatever. But yeah, I think it is kind of notorious. I think they did basically throw away what they shot in the first 2 weeks of that movie, if I remember correctly.
Oh,
and
there's a lot of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of anecdotes of them being like give me a second. Let me think about what this is.
Okay.
And stuff. Yeah. And then the music.
I'm glad they did that.
Obviously. I agree. Oh yeah. Also, he just made Magnolia, so obviously his head's gonna be in like a really crazy place as far as storytelling goes. But
it's whenever I think of Magnolia, him making Magnolia, I think of the moment in at the cinema where Tim Heidecker's character just goes, "My head's in about 1,000 places right now."
That's and a beautifully said thing.
So serious.
Yeah.
I love that's one of the best things Tim Heidecker's ever said is when he just looks at the camera and goes, "I'm gonna be fucking honest with you guys, my head's in about 1,000 places."
So right? good.
That's just the most dickhead thing he could have said.
Yeah, it's
moment.
Such a good
selfish and evil.
Yep. Okay, go on.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Paul Thomas Anderson has rarely commented on the movie since its release, and it remains his least known film. By 2015, mm-hmm. DVD copies were selling for over $100 online. And in 2018, Anderson said he was working on a Blu-ray release. However, an Australian Blu-ray was released by ViaVision in October 2020 with two commentaries, a deleted scene, and footage from the Sundance Institute Filmmaker Lab.
Wow.
Kind of cool.
Pretty nice. For the completionist out there. For the Australian completionist out there.
Crikey, mate, I'm going to hit that dingo with me Blu-ray. or something like that. Assistant cameraman Michael G. Ribba turned down 2 weeks of work on Waterworld, which paid better to work on this movie. Ribba has been the assistant cameraman on every PTA film since.
Fucking good for him. That's awesome.
That's honestly that's a beautiful thing to me.
Yeah, definitely. That is something paying off so well in ways you can't even predict. But I mean, I'm imagining you're on set and you're watching this fucking crazy 24-year-old like fucking cocaine talk his way through every direction. And you're like, he might be right. He might have he might be like the best filmmaker ever. I don't know.
And I have no idea, and I just have to pull focus.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, hey, man, the second you see any of those dailies, and you're just like, God, look at those casino lights. Jesus Christ.
And you're like, I think I made the right call.
Yeah.
Also, being on set for Waterworld, notoriously, disastrous film versus a small movie about hustlers.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, definitely. Quality of life alone, going to do Hard Eight and getting paid less or not paid at all, seems much more worth it than working on something like, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's spectacle's fun, but it doesn't seem like it's fun to make.
No, it's probably really bad to make. And a thing I always think about is the first time I ever watched Heat, Michael Mann's Heat, which films all over Los Angeles.
Yeah.
When he goes to those really shitty, basically homeless encampments in east of downtown. The only thing I could think at the time I watched it the first time, because I was doing a lot of PAing at that time.
Sure.
The only thing I could think of was, man, that must be a bitch to set up base
camp. Oh, God, telling me.
That's the only thing I could think.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. My brain is also broken in the same way of this must have been impossible to make. I can't imagine even enjoying myself doing this.
100%. And then it's like, oh, well, who cares because the movie's so good? And then you're like, well, I care because I know what it's like to be so fucking uncomfortable on set because you're like, hey, we should film this on the side of a cliff for some reason. I got two more for you. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Thanks. Anderson, thank you. Anderson wanted the film to open with just the production company info and a P.T. Anderson picture and the title with no other credits. In order for this to happen, all members of the cast and crew must agree to waive their main credit right. Producer Robert Jones did not consent, so the movie has full opening credits. Wow. One guy stood in the way of that happening. Robert Jones, you're my fool of the week. you're my stupid fuck of the week. Sorry, Robert Jones, producer.
Egg on his face. I don't know. I mean, at least they found that fucking music cue. Thank God. But otherwise, yeah, it's like, why do you have to, you know, do that? It's whatever.
And then last but not least, when the funds ran out, Paul Thomas Anderson used money that New Line Cinema had advanced for him for Boogie Nights and donations from his cast and crew to raise the necessary $250,000 to finish the film.
Jesus.
Reicher signed off on the Anderson director cut on the proviso that he changed the title to Hard Eight. Although Anderson agreed to this change, it didn't stop Reicher from barely releasing the film.
Yeah.
So the important part of this to me in the PTA grand story is this movie wasn't even done.
Yeah.
And he already had permission to make Boogie Nights. Mm-hmm. That is so crazy, yeah. Bro.
There's a great oral history out there that I kind of, maybe I didn't finish, but like I got like halfway to 3/4 of the way through that. Yeah. Showed like this guy like kind of came in like a fireball to every executive and anyone who could possibly help him make the movie. And like, yeah. The fact that he even like pulled off Boogie Nights, I think, is even more impressive than making Hard Eight somehow. But Hard Eight is like incredible film school for him. It seems like it was just like to get to actually work with someone like, you know, with Elswit and all of his collaborators that he's eventually going to build. But like, yeah, the fact that then it's like, oh, they're letting me do whatever I want on Boogie Nights or whatever. And he has to like kind of push through with that, you know, trying to hold on to that until the very end and release his cut or whatever, is in itself the kind of birth of the PTA that we know and appreciate, I guess. In itself.
It's nuts.
Yeah, it's really nuts.
Feels like it will never happen again. Like, honestly.
And not in this current condition, at least. It's like, I don't know. The only interesting thing currently happening right now is that Noah Baumbach seems to have spent a lot of Netflix's money and gone. It's severely over budget for his new movie. And I'm like very excited about that. Yeah, I agree. I'm like, yeah, you should do that because it's like, yeah. I want you to see you do something that's not about getting divorced.
As much as we love getting divorced on this podcast.
Look, folks, that's like the thing I do every week.
I get divorced from my wife. And then I take all of her money and I say, don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you, and then kick her to the curb.
Yep.
Fun for me.
You do that.
Noah! What?
What's going on?
What's going on? Rocky, thanks for asking. Time for some categories, bitch. Woo! So every week we're going to do the same categories and give out some awards. If you listen to It's On The List, we used to give a Mercedes Valuable Player, occasionally a Zevon, which meant the most underrated thing. This week, we're going to introduce all these topics and categories to you. A lot of them are self-explanatory. Some of them are not. I'll give a brief explanation of each. Rocky, I'm going to go ahead and give you first dibs at these categories and awards every single week.
Okay.
But the first one up is favorite scene. Pretty straightforward. What's your favorite scene in the movie? Rocky, tell me.
I mean, it's got to be the Philip Seymour Hoffman one. I think it's like the one thing that really makes this movie, I don't know, it's like the one thing that really stands out from this movie as like the major emergence of PTA, or like as a major PTA moment or whatever. What's it called? Honorable mentions to the scenes where John C. Reilly learns that Sydney says, I love you to John C. Reilly. And you get sure. to like, you see John C. Reilly's like, lips quiver. Like, I think that is like also another beautiful PTA moment. But yeah, the fucking, it's obvious to me, it's the Hard Eight sequence, like the actual Hard Eight sequence.
I got a different answer, if you can believe it.
That's actually great. I'm happy that you have a different answer.
You're pissed and you're gonna kill me after this. that I have a different idea. My favorite scene slash sequence of this movie is the rate card scam.
Yeah,
like I think there's a lot of fun filmmaking happening in that moment that mm-hmm. is not necessarily the same type of shit he's gonna do, you know, in the next especially two movies he does.
Sure.
But it's like analogous. Like, yeah. I feel that energy build in a very special way in that moment. And I still, and I think it makes it even more special that I don't understand what the fuck the rate card scam actually is that we talked about earlier. But that is my favorite sequence in the movie. But I didn't forget about the heartache Philip Seymour Hoffman thing. So don't worry, that's going to come up soon. But before that, Rocky, what is your favorite shot in this movie?
This is a very, I don't know, this feels like a weird pick, but it's the shot where the cuffs and the gun are thrown into the sewer.
Okay, sure.
Yeah,
yes.
I'd say that John Bryan also has a huge part to do with that, because there's like the mandolin playing in the back and it's insanely melancholic and mysterious. But yes, that feels like such a beautiful noir touch. And also PTA, like, kind of maybe an underrated thing about his work is that he's really good at close-ups. And there's something about like
great close-ups,
hearing the item hit the surface that it's being thrown onto or something, or being pulled off of, or just jingling or being used or whatever. But yeah, seeing the gun hit go into the thing and the cuffs in like kind of soft slow motion as the sun is coming up is a very, very beautiful and kind of haunting moment for me. And that's the most like neo-noirish moment of this neo-noir movie.
Great pick.
Thanks.
Amazing pick.
I'm glad you liked it.
Love that moment. Thank you. Thank you. Kiss, kiss, Okay, do you want to go over here and go on the big Ferris wheel? Okay, cool. Let's go on the big Ferris wheel. Oh, we have to wait in line because there's a 12-year-old stuck in the gears.
Oh, that's
the
Ferris wheel. That's so terrible. I wish you can kiss for a moment.
My favorite shot is the opening shot.
Of course.
Great. We kind of talked about it already, so I don't need to really go into detail on it, but I love that opening shot. Great wide, great dolly or push in or whatever it is. Close up on the John C. Reilly character, but you get the presence of this of the Sydney character as well. Mm-hmm. I think it is got some great PTA warmth that ends up kind of imbuing a lot of the rest of his movies. Rocky, what is your favorite line in this movie?
Good golly, Marie. That was it. No.
Nice.
I must have written it down somewhere. Yeah, it's such a PTA line. Just the like, it's always nice to make a new friend. Like, there's something, yeah. It reminds me of something like from The Master, because that movie is also filled with lines that feel like they're almost being said to a child. Like, they're like,
sure.
The language is so simple to make sure that the heart based intent is as clear as possible. And yeah, I think there's something about that moment that is just really heartwarming that like, they don't even know how much that rings true. But in the moment, it is so like in like the simplest way, like, yeah, it's so nice meeting someone who I can trust and, you know, can consider a friend. So that's my line.
I got two lines, kind of a 1A, 1B situation. Okay, I'm doing this. This is my decision. It's my decision to do this.
I believe you. I believe you.
Let me do this, please, for fuck's sake. So, sorry. I'm mad at you for that, by the way. I'm actually pissed off. My two favorite lines are both lines said by John C. Reilly. I will fuck you up if you fuck with me, okay? I know three kinds of karate, jujitsu, aikido, and regular karate. It's just funny. It's just a funny fucking thing to say, and it gives you a lot of insight into where the John character is at in that moment. Totally. And what is otherwise kind of a... There's a bunch of tension in that scene because you don't know what Sydney's true intentions are, and that's a great little moment of levity. And then the thing that you said earlier when Clementine and John have to kind of get their shit together and he says, go to Niagara Falls. And he says, oh, I've already been to Niagara Falls. I don't want to go there. So those are my two John C. Reilly lines in the movie that really, really stood out to me. Those are my favorite lines.
Yep. Oh, also like the entirety of Philip Seymour Hoffman's dialogue. I think this movie is also an honorable mention for me for sure.
Yes.
Shakalaka doobie doo is maybe one of the better lines.
Shakalaka doobie doo is so good, bestie.
Yeah.
So good. Fucking good, bestie. So good. Rocky, what is the best musical moment for you in this movie?
I think I mentioned it at the top, but basically as John is warming up to Sydney and agreeing to like, you know, go on the road trip with him to Reno or whatever, that moment with the pianos and the clarinets and the horns building up into like a kind of cathartic explosion, I think is really awesome, and also just like the kind of first sign of what PTA is capable of as a full-fledged filmmaker. I that's my favorite musical moment.
I think more or less that's the same for me. I just wrote down the entire diner sequence because
sure,
it starts out as diegetic music, mm-hmm. and it's like really nice. And then as it goes on, it changes and builds and swells into non-diegetic music. Yeah. And just the recognition of that build is beautiful to me. So that entire moment of music is my pick for best musical moment. That whole scene, basically. I love when a scene is underscored by musicality and music the entire time. Mm-hmm. And why I liked, not related to PTA at all, but the first 40 minutes of Nope are all underscored by musicality.
Yeah.
And in that moment, I did think, oh, this is kind of like Punch Drunk Love. Is this going to be my new, like, all-time favorite movie? And then the rest of the movie is kind of very different.
I swear to God, with Us and Nope, Jordan Peele is like one of the closer filmmakers to actually emulating what PTA emulates in his movies.
Yes.
They kind of are close to something, both of them. I can't even like, you have to like really do alchemy to break down what specifically it is. But yeah, I agree with you on that. And you're talking about music. Oh, I also say in a similar vein, the music when they're leaving the motel is insanely uncomfortable and intense and very like kind of Punch Drunk Love, like just industrial scary noises.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like banging on pipes and chain link fences and shit.
Yeah, just super, super, super scary and really, really good work from everyone involved.
Speaking of really good work for everyone involved, this next award is the Luis Guzman Humanitarian Award for the most underrated element of the film, Rocky. Who, what, or which gets your Luis Guzman Humanitarian Award?
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I do think John Bryant is kind of like an undersung. I mean, I know Michael Penn is also involved and they do great work together, but like, yeah, the jazz music in this movie really adds to that specific sleepy, sad tone that I think about when I think about Heartache. And when I look back on Heartache at its best, it is this kind of wandering, roving, purgatory in casinos with like lounge jazz music playing. And I think, I don't know, man, John Bryant, I wish he would work with PTA again at some point. But like this is up there with as far as like their great work together goes, in my opinion.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. I'm going to give a tie between the crap scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman because it's just like that moment should be in every Philip Seymour Hoffman highlight reel. And I don't think it is.
Immortalized. Absolutely agreed. Yeah.
So that scene, as well as Elswit's photography in this movie, mm-hmm. because it does kind of set the tone for a lot of the textural and just choices for how a lot of these early movies with him look, mm-hmm. you know, and it's easy to disregard it because it's not as flashy or as big or as bombastic as it does get later.
Yeah.
So I'll throw Elswit a bone in that respect for, you know, it's still really good. It's just not what we later come to expect. It's done very differently. It's much more of the genre of a thriller, neo-noir type thing. So those get my recognition for the Luis Guzman Humanitarian Award.
Mm-hmm.
Rocky, this next category I actually just came up with on the fly yesterday, so you have not been briefed on them yet, but it's actually a three-part category. Are you ready?
Holy
for, you ready
shit, for this? What the fuck? Hey, character, what the fuck?
What the fuck are you fucking talking about? Character most likely to say, yup, in this movie.
Fuck you. wow. Okay, I guess I have to think about that.
My answer is the Philip Seymour Hoffman character.
It's obviously the Philip Seymour Hoffman character. Yeah.
Yeah. Who I don't think ever is named. I think he's just known as Young Gambler.
Yeah, I agree. Yes.
So that's my pick. Next is character most likely to say Swag or Swag 9000.
Oh, John. It's John. Yeah. He's going to say
John
that.
C. Riley is who I put that down as well.
Yeah.
100%. Agreed. And then character also most likely to say yikey uh-oh.
I'm going to give it to Sydney, actually.
Damn, I like that. I put down Melora Walters.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I like the idea of after assessing the motel situation. Because in the quotes page on IMDb, there's a line, a loose line that just is, this is a very fucked up situation. So the idea of him saying like, this is very yucky, oh.
I like that way super more than entertaining. The Laura Walters. I like that so much.
Sure.
Shout out to Laura Walters. Shout out to Melora Walters. Thank you.
Excited to talk about her in the next two episodes, and then Magno. No, the Master. Go on.
And then never again.
Yeah.
Sorry, Melora Walters. This next category is called the PTAs. PART. What is the most PTA part of Hard Eight?
I honestly think it's like the opening, the scheme, like the first casino scheme. I think is the most
rate card stuff.
Yeah. But also, you know, in a way, it's Sydney watching the wedding video.
Oh,
I think
good call.
I think that is what every PTA movie boils down to.
Interesting. That's a really good pick.
Yeah. I think that kind of ties its DNA into Boogie Nights and Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love as far as this like really kind of like heartbreaking moment.
It's a great pick. I'm not going to pick that because I do like my pick as well for a different reason, but that is a great pick for that category. For me, it's what actually you brought up at the very beginning of the conversation, which is Sydney walking the casino floors, those tracking shots of him just sort of walking around the casino floors. We're really not seeing the front of his head. We're mostly seeing profile and back of his head.
Definitely.
There's something so magical about those moments to me where we can just kind of take in these weird little environments with these very weird little characters on the fringes, following our very beleaguered protagonist in one way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So to me, that is the most PTA part of the film. But I'm gonna say that you won that pick big time. So with Melora Walters, with the wedding video.
I pulled that out of my asshole.
You pulled it out of your asshole, big asshole, big asshole.
I will
guy.
Say from now on, when I'm writing notes on these movies, I'm gonna have the categories in my notes so I can address them and not figure them out on the fly as we're doing right now.
That's probably good. That's probably a good call.
Yeah.
In the PTA ranking scale, where does this movie rank for you in all of PTA's films?
I actually have this list on my Letterboxd, but for now, it's second from the bottom.
There we go. For me, it's bottom right now, bottom of the barrel, but I reserve the right to ultimately change these rankings by the time this podcast ends.
You know, any rewatch of his movies is going to naturally kind of put it, you know, like push things around or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, as of now, it is the movie right above The Last Place.
Okay, great. I kind of thought that actually. That's what I thought you were going to say as well.
Yeah.
And then last but not least, last category before we go into our final segment, who's your MVP?
Well, so great. I mean, God, it is so Philip Baker Hall's thing, and I guess it has to go to him, but I don't know. Phil Seymour Hoffman, I think, really wins this movie.
Yeah, it's Philip Baker Hall. There's no, I think it's easy to say. I think that's an easy call.
There you go.
Personally, I think that's
no,
an easy
for,
to call.
For sure, yeah. I'm going to give it to him also, but it is just so, he's right there. Phil Seymour Hoffman's right there. Yeah, Philip Baker Hall. I'm so glad that PTA weaseled his way into making this movie and that Philip Baker Hall agreed to this young PA who went up to him and was like, Secret Honor's fucking tight, yo. I have this idea for you. You can play this old gambler man. Like, yeah, I'm so glad that he took a gamble on this kid.
If that happened now of days, you would be on some list on the Universal backlog.
Yeah, you would not be allowed in. Exactly. But also, like, fucking anyone who does that is like, who the fuck is that kid? That's Ernie Anderson's kid. So PTA is kind of lucky a little bit. But he also makes
chip
his
on
own
his
luck.
Shoulder.
Definitely. Yeah, he's like, no, I'm not just Ernie Anderson's kid. And he kind of proved that, I guess. So.
And he was very correct that he's not just Ernie
Anderson's kid. He's not just Ernie Anderson's kid. It's true.
Goulardi.
Yeah. Yup.
Yup. Well, Rocky, those are the categories. We got one more segment to do today.
Oh, shit.
This movie, correct that it is takes place at a casino, a lot of it, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say so.
So, Rocky,
we're
going to play a little game called What Are the Odds?
Wow. Okay. All right.
I'm going to play a little game called What Are the Odds? I am going to describe an event to you and you are with the odds imbued in the description, and you are have to guess what that thing is that I'm describing. Does that make sense?
I think so. So I'm sorry, I'm on my Tumblr right now. Can you repeat that?
Bro, get off your Tumblr, bro. Come on.
Sorry, bro. Describe it one more time and then I'll play it.
Okay.
Closing my eyes.
I'm going to give you a description and the odds of an event happening, and you have to guess what that event is based on the description and the odds.
Okay. All right, let's do it.
Great. First question. This event is shocking because the chances of it happening are 1 in 1.2 million in a given year. And if it were to happen, it'd be pretty electric. Rocky, what is the odds?
Getting struck by lightning.
Oh, Rocky, unfortunately, that is incorrect. The odds are smashing your penis in an outlet and saying, that's the flavor.
Wow.
So unfortunately, that is, you don't get the point on that one.
Oh, shit. Oh, fuck. Okay, all right.
But don't worry, there are five more.
Okay,
so
good.
You don't have to get your you don't have to give your hopes down.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, I'm giving my hopes down.
Yeah, I know, but I don't want you to, because there's five more beautiful things for you to try and guess right now. Are you ready for number two?
Hell yeah,
I'm ready for number two. how's that for a joke on a podcast?
Yeah,
how's that?
You know who said that? My toilet.
Yeah, you know, said that, my ass on my toilet bowl. Here we go. Don't let the idea of this happening put you in a spin cycle. The odds of this event occurring are 1 in 13 million, but if it were to happen to you, you can bet your tight little ass you'd be saying, Toto, I have a feeling we aren't in Kansas anymore. Rocky, what are the odds?
Getting stuck inside of a washing machine and getting taken advantage of by your step-sibling.
Oh, Rocky, unfortunately, you were incorrect. It's finding Judy Garland's body and putting it on as a skin suit for your community theater production of Judgment at Nuremberg.
Damn, I was so close.
I know, you were so close. I tried to make it very obvious with the tornado thing.
I know.
But unfortunately, it is finding Judy Garland's body and putting it on as a skin suit for your theater production of Judgment at Nuremberg.
Okay, fair enough.
Does that piss you off? Are there any, got that one wrong?
I'm pretty pissed. Are there any clues for Judgment at Nuremberg in the intro of it? Say it again. Nope. Okay, cool. Fair enough. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome, Chef.
All right.
I hope that you do not get your hopes down on this.
I'm giving my hopes down.
Okay, that sucks. The chances of this next event happening is just 3%. But for the lucky few who do, they have their pick of the litter and can have their asses sat down in any chair they desire. Rocky, what are the odds? Sat down. Think of the letters S and the other letters in there.
Sat down. Getting...
Think of the letters of the word sat.
S-A-T. Oh, like getting a perfect score on your SATs?
Rocky, I swear to God, I wish I could say that was correct. Unfortunately, it is incorrect. The correct answer is getting up in the middle of the SAT and blowing the test proctor / eating them out to climax and still deciding to go to ITT Technical Institute.
Duh, of course. What am I fucking thinking, dude? Come on.
You trained for this.
Bro. I know. All right, I'm going to get this next one for real, though. I'm going to get it.
All right, I believe you. Please don't get your hopes down. If you abstain from marijuana consumption throughout your whole life, you will go to heaven. Studies show that that's just something I wanted to throw in there. That's nothing to do with anything else.
Okay.
Studies show that the likelihood of this next event happening are twice. Studies show that the likelihood of this next event happening twice in a row is 1 in a billion, but the odds of it happening once are 1 in 835. That's no foul play. Rocky, keep your eye on the ball. What are the odds?
This is about having sex with one of the running sausages at the Brewers Stadium in Milwaukee.
Rocky, it pains me so much to say once again that you are fucking wrong.
I'm sorry I'm bringing you so much pain.
It sucks for me. I'm thinking of quitting. Thinking of ending things. Sitting on the top row of Fenway Park and slipping in a way that causes you to go down every single step like that scene in Hot Rod. And once you get to the bottom, your teeth are piano keys and you spring up and down like an accordion.
Yeah, Yeah.
I should have known that, bro.
I should have known that. I studied for this.
You did. You studied for this, and you're fucking up so bad.
I'm embarrassed. In this game. I'm embarrassed.
It's embarrassing for you. I'm honestly glad that it's just you and me who are going to hear this, and not a million people who are going to hear you do this.
Yeah, thank God you're not recording.
Yeah, thank God this is all just for us. Next up, the odds of this next event happening are 1 in 340,000, which is approximately the amount of money my ex-wife took from me, even though we had a prenup. But if you want some independence, don't get yourself worked up and fiery. If it does happen to you, you fucking piece of shit. Rocky, what are the odds? Independence, fiery, work.
Getting... hit by fireworks?
Oh, Rocky, no! You son of a bitch. The correct answer is swallowing a firework hole, having it blow up inside of you, and everyone saying, yup, grandma's beans will do that to you. Yup.
What are the
odds?
We're just
going to go to
the last. What are the odds if you remove one of those yups? Does it go higher or lower?
We're just going to go to the last question. I don't have time to answer that.
All right, fine.
Last but not least, unclench your jaws and listen to me finish the game. The odds of this happening range anywhere from 1 in 3.7 million to 1 in 7 million, depending on where you live. Rocky, for the godforsaken last time, what are the odds?
What are the odds of you raw dogging a shark?
Incorrect, dying of a shark attack. Rocky, thank you so much for playing. What are those odds? Really sucks that you did not get a single point right. And as consolation, you can go ahead and get your plugs off first. The floor is yours.
I fucking hate myself. This is so stupid. God damn it.
God fucking damn it. This fucking sucks. I hate this fucking game in the show. Look at this fucking shit. Fucking shit.
Yeah, you can watch me and some other funny people every Monday and Thursday at 8 p.m. Pacific at twitch.tv/everythingnowshow. We have an interactive comedy show that we do for 2 hours every Monday and Thursday. We have a main character in a situation where they are like, you know, driving a Lyft, or they are hiring and firing people at their job, or they're a man on the street reporter trying to report the news. And you can interact with the show in many, many, many ways. You can pay money and affect the way the show goes. You can kill our characters. It's a madhouse. It's like Blue's Clues for adults. Come check it out. Everything Now Show, twitch.tv/everythingnowshow, Mondays and Thursdays at 8 p.m. Pacific. And also you can find me on Letterboxd at R-O-N-C-K-Y. And I'm on Twitter at Rocky Pajarito. And I'm on Instagram at the Lawn Wrangler. Lawn Wrangler. I think I'm just Lawn Wrangler.
I think you're the Lawn Wrangler.
The personally. Lawn Wrangler. Okay.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah, you gotta check out the Everything Now show. Even the host of the show is even sometimes on it.
Yeah, sometimes. So. You were the last guest we had, and the last guest we'll ever have.
In a way.
Yeah. I gotta talk to you about something actually after this regarding your previous appearance. So let's keep on going.
Uh-oh. That sounds very scary to me. It's something I don't want to talk. It's something I don't want to hear or talk about.
No, it's good. It's good.
Okay. This is for real. August 26th, The Cat's Crawl in East Hollywood at 8 p.m. Pacific. I will be doing my first ever stand-up set on the show, air-conditioned comedy. It is currently sold out. Follow their page on Instagram. There may be a way to do watch for a discount via live stream. That's not confirmed yet, though, so please do not come to my house with pitchforks and torches saying, you told us we could watch it on the live stream. I didn't fucking say shit, by the way, about that. I didn't fucking say shit.
Yeah.
But I am very excited to be doing that. Hopefully there are more opportunities if you're unable to make it to that because that one is sold out. Or if you're Rocky and I told him about it the very first moment it happened and he said, actually, I'm not going to go to that because I hate your ass.
I had tickets I pre-planned. I have a thing. I'm sorry.
It's fine. I'm just not that. It's actually not that big of a deal to me at all. I also do the Everything Now show, like I said, frequently. I'm a regular guest on there, so if you have never heard of me or Rocky before this, you can watch me on that show every so often. You can also follow this show on Twitter and Instagram at MyFavePod on Twitter and at @MyFavorite_podcast on Instagram. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram. Read my bathroom guide. That's something I don't plug very much.
Yeah.
Read my bathroom guide that I wrote about all the different places I pissed and shit over the course of the last year on my travels.
It's true and you should do it.
It's true and you should do it. says my friend and co-host who I love. I think that's all the plugs I got. Rocky, I'm excited to see you next week when we talk about Boogie Nights.
Booger Nights.
And for that, I say, bye-bye.
Dup, dup, dup. Dup, dup, dup.
Fuck.
Fuck, fuck, fuck.
Fuck. Fuck.
Great song.
All right, see ya.